described as fury. The report revealed that explosive files showed how Big Oil lied to the public and U.S. Congress about their climate targets. Why does this trend continue, something dating back possibly even decades? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how these big energy companies, while raking in billions of dollars in profits due to high energy prices, continue to dodge and lie about their green responsibilities, all the while endangering the planet even more. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Will Maydon joins us, Executive Director of the Climate Action Network International from Beirut. Also joining us is Jody Grage, Vice Chair of the Green Party of Washington State, who joins us from Seattle.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Well Maydon, and ask you about this revelation, which is supposed to be shocking, based on a report which described it as I mentioned in the intro, explosive files over these large oil companies. However, it's not that shocking, is it? Because it's a repeated scenario. What's your impression when you heard about this?
Sure. First, let me correct one thing. I've changed my position. I'm not anymore the CEO of Can International, but just to clarify this, no, there's no problem. In relation to the topic, no, it wasn't a surprise at all. I mean, we've been always getting information from what the fossil fuel industry thinks and what they say. They knew even before the policymakers in the 80s and even before that CO2 causes global warming, and they tried to hide these facts for a long time. So this is not something new for us as climate activists. We've been working on this issue for a long time on policy, and we knew that this is happening. It's the first time that has been exposed in such a way that really is creating ripples. And this is important because the last line of defense against fighting climate change is actually this vested interest. Now, working on climate change is not only good for the environment and saving the planet and future generation, but it's good for the economy. It's economically viable. The technology is there. We can solve the problem with existing technology. The only problem is political will, and what's holding this political will is the vested interest of some individuals and some companies, especially the fossil fuel industry. And that's why these few individuals are holding the whole globe hostage. And this is what we need to deal with to actually finally solve the climate change issue.
Okay, well, let's take a look, Jody Grage, at the fact that you're having the way this has been described, and I'd like to get your impression on it, as to whether they're being kind to them when it says internal documents showed companies attempted to distance themselves. Now, do you think that that's the correct way of describing it when you take a look at the history of these oil companies, which we're going to get into who they are?
Well, I think you only have to look at the example of the tobacco companies that lied for decades about smoking causing cancer. And you need to look at all the pharmaceutical companies that were getting rich from the COVID pandemic. I think that the oil companies are simply part of the ranks of the industries that are intent on making as much short-term profit as possible. And, you know, the world and the people in it and the whole system of the earth as it's developed be damned. So I don't think anyone should be shocked at the continuation of this line of thinking by large industrial complexes.
Okay, let me get your idea, if I may, about what has occurred. Now, based on the reports and how it's been covered, you have a congressional hearing that was held in Washington, D.C. You have an investigation into the role of these companies. And then you have these companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP. The House Committee on Oversight and Reform were the ones who did this investigation. And you have the oil companies who testified last year, in which it says that they denied misleading the public. First of all, given the history of these companies, how do you have an investigation into these accusations of which, for sure, they're guilty of, and it takes 1 year before you actually come out with some findings? Now, either these people who are in this investigative committee are trying to portray a different image, or they're strong lobby groups, which these companies do have, lobbying some of these congressmen and women in the U.S. House.
Well, as your other guest said, we have a good example of the tobacco industry. They were able to delay action on tobacco for a long time. And only when those working on the Tobacco Control Convention have been able to include a specific article that prevents the tobacco industry from interfering in tobacco control legislation, when the convention came out and the solution started to happen. And this happened directly when this big scandal came out. Similar to this one, there was this big scandal, and then there was a decision to exclude tobacco industry in putting tobacco control legislation, being involved. Any legislator that gets contacted by the tobacco industry in relation to tobacco legislation, they have to inform the Tobacco Control Convention Secretariat that they've been contacted to do this and that. So they have to report it. It's illegal for legislators to talk to the tobacco industry in relation to tobacco control. We need something similar for the fossil fuel industry. At the moment, the fossil fuel industry is at the heart of the negotiation. They are in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. They are talking to legislators. They are talking to leaders. They are talking to everyone about what they want and what they need. They're selling wrong solutions and so on. They need to be outside of conversation because there's a huge conflict of interest. Although Paris was achieved, the Paris Climate Agreement was achieved because there were progressive businesses involved. The business could play a constructive role if they want to. But unfortunately, the fossil fuel, they say they want to do that, but as you can see, they are lying and it's not happening. So this is the problem. I think we need to mirror what happened to the Tobacco Control Convention, to the climate change negotiation, remove them out of the conversation until they prove they really want to solve this problem.
All right. This is the part that I'm having a problem with. I'm hoping that other people actually look at it also and question this, Jody Grage. I mean, come on. Isn't there a way that when you have these big, huge, multi-billion-dollar conglomerates make pledges, first of all, that there's a control of some kind, that there's some kind of organization controlling the emissions that they're emitting, number one? And number two, when they make pledges, don't they have deadlines? Don't they have commitments? Don't they have penalties? Don't they have a game plan and somebody who's overseeing this, which we're not seeing neither happening here? Am I correct to question this?
Well, they don't.
This is for Jody Grage. I'm sorry. Well, go ahead, Jody Grage. I'll get to you on that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jody Grage.
One of the problems is if you're looking at the legislators to do this, it's not going to happen because of the fantastic, ridiculous amount of money that the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry and weapons producers and pharmaceutical companies contribute to the legislatures. To think that while all this money comes in, the legislatures are not paying attention to that and are doing what is best for the world as a whole, that's at this point a fantasy. So yes, there needs to be legislation. I don't believe it would be easy to get it passed, but why don't we pull in some of these other organizations that are buying the votes to keep doing what they are doing?
Which organizations are buying the folks?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies, the military industrial complex. Big business is doing its very best to keep the legislatures on their side, and they're holed up in Washington, D.C., and they're paying attention to those people, not to their constituents or the condition of the world as a whole. So I think the example of what's been done with the tobacco industry is a good one to follow, and I certainly think the oil companies should be under that same sort of oversight. But, you know, I think there's further room for further development of that concept.
Indeed.
Over.
Well, when we take a look at what the these oil giants have pledged, basically they've relied on unproven technology, as it was reported, and accounting gimmicks, misleading language, in order for them to hide the reality, is how this was described. And then it goes on to say how they're laughing at the people trying to protect the planet while they knowingly work to destroy it. When we take a look at the unproven technology, what does that mean exactly? Is it along the lines of they are sowing doubts, perhaps, as to whether the green energy is going to work or not in terms of preventing the rise in climate temperature, I guess, or global warming, I should say?
Look, first, I think these companies are doing what's in their best interest and what they're doing. At the end, their pledges are voluntary. No one forced these pledges on them. They went forward and said, these are our pledges. So that's why there's no oversight. It's just them taking this initiative to show that they are progressive, to show that they want to engage in this issue, to keep being involved in these discussions, that they're saying that we want to play games, so don't shut us out and so on. They don't want to look bad to the consumer and so on. So that's why they're doing these pledges. They're voluntary. No one can monitoring them. And then they come and say, we're going to solve this by building, let's say, a fossil fuel and attach to it a specific machine that would suck this CO2, you know, carbon capture and storage, and other geoengineering kind of solutions that is unproven technology. Some of it's really dangerous and scary. So there is a solution that exists, but they're trying to find other solutions that would allow them to continue burning fossil fuels as much as they want. So my thinking is that, you know, you're not going to change them that much. There's vested interest. Only their shareholders maybe can hold them accountable, but reaching that shareholders, we tried and we've worked. A lot of organizations are working on that. It's really hard. In my opinion, they need to be left out of the conversation and work on the demand rather than the supply. If the world adopts 100% renewable energy target, you know, the U.S. did that for the electricity. Most of Europe did that. A lot of more than 150 countries have adopted 100% renewable energy target. You just remove the demand, then the supply has to follow. And we see it in the electrification of transport. You know, this huge, increase or improvement in the electric car happened in the recent years. Such an improvement because of legislation, because of countries said they want to decarbonize their economy, starting with the transport sector and the electricity sector. Uh-huh. So the car industry, when they saw that there's a huge economic opportunity by switching to electric cars, they went for it. Now we talk to the industry, they tell us, you know, we're ready to switch. Just make sure that the government's prepared all the legislation correctly. And, you know, you have charging stations, everything. We are ready to switch. They are not the bottleneck anymore in terms of switching the transport sector. Of course, in countries like Germany, they still have influence. But, you know, even Mercedes, they're producing a car that can go 1,000 kilometers in one charge. You see what others in Japan and other countries, the industry is ready, and we don't see it as a big problem. The fossil fuel industry is still making, you know, their profits. You look at their profits increasing rather than decreasing from fossil fuels. They don't see the same kind of profit from renewable energy. The minute the economics work for renewable energy more, and this is what the governments can do. The minute governments make more profit from renewable energy, these companies have no choice but to switch.
All right. I'm going to ask you this question before we move on to what is really at the heart of the matter here, at least in terms of the lens that I'm looking at. Jody Graich, it appears when you look at the statements made there by the Oversight Committee, the person that was presenting it, there was a huge billboard behind her of which it said, profits for ExxonMobil, so many billions of dollars. In the case of ExxonMobil, it came in at $17.9 billion for 3 months. BP, roughly around the same, a little more, a little less. Do you think that this is being raised at this point because they are seeing how these big oil and gas companies making so much money while the rest of the citizens of, for example, in the U.S. may be suffering because of a result of high energy prices, that they want to cap the amount of profits that these companies make or tax them maybe even more because there's an energy crunch and crisis, not only just in the U.S., but pretty much around the world?
Well, there are some considerations that should be mentioned here. One is that the technology that is being developed also has its costs. It has environmental costs from mining. It uses rare materials. The amount of the expense of the materials used and the process used to develop these things is not inconsequential. So part of the conundrum here is if you feel a need to make sure that the companies who are doing the next phase of things beyond the oil industry also continue to make massive quantities of money, the whole solution to climate change then becomes dependent on letting the next technology thing make all this money. But you have limits. The Earth has limits, which we are exceeding as far as population, consumption, the availability of raw materials. So it is not reasonable to think that the only carrot, the only way we have of making companies do the next thing is to enable them to make obscene amounts of money while many people have nothing, just like the oil and gas industry has done. We need to refocus things on a longer term basis, and we need to take away money as the only incentive. Some shareholder groups are trying to do this without an awful lot of success, but we're in a recalibrating point that has to do with the carrying capacity of the Earth.
Well, first of all, when you say that, the recalibrating point, that point was reached on many different COP climate conferences, et cetera. We're going to get to a couple of those conferences, but I'd like to do a history check with you, if I may, and really put the focus on the integrity, the ethics that are involved here, or lack of it, should I say. And the prime example that comes up with is what was called the climate deception dossiers. I don't know if you remember that, going back, some more than decades ago, where the whole purpose of these big oil companies was to deceive people by sowing doubt whether climate change, does it really exist? Is the temperature of the globe, of the Earth, really rising? And that was their whole plan, spending millions of dollars to basically promote misinformation. Tell us if we're looking at that to have just prevailed throughout all the years, even now when we hear a report like this come out in the news.
Yeah, again, I said we weren't surprised because we've been seeing it for a long period of time, and actually the fossil fuel industry did succeed. They did succeed in delaying action on the international level, especially, and in the U.S. for a long period of time. And the late 80s, early 90s, the coal industry, U.S. coal industry, if I remember correctly, have trained the Saudi Arabia negotiating team to negotiate in the climate change negotiations to make sure, because you know they had similar interests, which is the fossil fuel economy. But we were able to shift that. Yes, it took us a lot of time. It made us waste a lot of valuable time, and we are now at a stage where we want to do the transformational change faster than before. And you know, in relation to solution, yes, everything has impact. Even us as civil society can have impact in our work. Of course, there should be regulations. It's the regulations from the governments that's going to make the companies adopt correct solutions that don't harm people and planet. You cannot rely on morality. Morality is very subjective. It goes down to the individual. It's not a company. At the end, individuals run these corporations. I've seen some businesses, big businesses, that are more progressive and more inspiring than some civil society organization. So it's just individuals. But just rely on morality and making sure that everyone has this kind of ideology and kind of the way, like, if you want to wait until the planet or the globe, the population on the globe, has this kind of awareness and acts in good faith to save others and think about others, we're not gonna save the planet or the civilization on this planet. What definitely we need is to find solutions that preserve the planet within its boundaries. We believe there are two limits. There is a smaller limit, mm-hmm. which is related to the limit of what you provide individuals in a welfare state, you know, basic healthcare, food, shelter, and so on. And then there's the outer limit, which is how much we can use the natural resources. And many studies have shown that you can live within existing planetary resources in the same kind of quality of life, in the same kind of population that exists on the planet, and it would work. The problem is some individuals are taking much more than others, and this is where the problem is. But it's also in relation to regulations by the government. To give an example, very concrete examples, just the subsidies that the fossil fuel industry receive, if they just remove that, it can tip the scales towards renewable energy. And we're not saying about making billions, not like trying to make the same companies make the same amount of money they're making right now. But what we mean is like
that's a good point.
The shift in what is good for the planet and the economy has to shift.
Sure, that's a very good point. I'm looking at the clock. We're really running short of time here. Let's move away from these big oil companies, Jody Grage, and look at other companies, other businesses. And this particular headline, which I'm going to forge into another piece of news or concept, I should say, came out in 2019, how 700 companies, which included companies like Facebook and Amazon, were accused of concealing their environmental impact. Basically, this leads to the whole notion of greenwashing, okay, where there's false pledges made towards how they are moving towards that in the way that their business products work. When you have this many companies of this stature that are basically lying about the fact that they're going green in one way or another, how can there be any hope then?
Well, it's pretty hard to see, all right, because the company's basic thrust is to make more money. So I think legislation and oversight has to do with it. I also think that people themselves and organizations can really look at the fact that too many people consuming too much stuff is not going to do it. There must be a better balance between of consumption and population. Climate change is, of course, affecting the poorest, the most, and
right.
that isn't sustainable.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vatari and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, discipline. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of discipline in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has emphasized on the discipline because He has created this universe with the discipline with the specific discipline. We know that the alternation of the day and night and the 365 days of a year where the Earth rotates or it goes around the sun. And the other things that are happening, these are all happening with the discipline. Even the sun and moon, the Earth, the planets, the stars, everything is moving under a discipline which is made by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And Allah has said, "Inna kulla shay'in khalaqna biqadarin," that certainly we have created everything biqadarin, with a discipline, under a discipline. And this discipline shows us that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in His creation, when He created everything, the skies and the earth and the heavens, the things that are moving around us, the universe, galaxies, everything that we see, it is under our discipline. Therefore, He also emphasizes us in having discipline in our life. And a true Muslim is a one who has discipline in his daily life, in his routine life. And this discipline is necessary, because if a person wants to be successful and he wants a success in his life, he must observe the discipline in his life. And if he is not observing the discipline, then obviously it is hard to have success in the life, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of discipline in the Islamic lifestyle, and we said that if you want success in your life, it is necessary to have discipline in your life. We must have discipline in our life. And we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He has created everything under a discipline, and we know that He is the wise, He is Hakim, Al-Hakim, He is the wise. And it is under His wisdom that we, as His, as the one who's been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we as the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if we want to have wisdom in our life, if we want to have knowledge in our life, it is necessary to observe discipline and have discipline in our routine life. And if we have a discipline in our routine life, then obviously we can reach to a place. We can see that how Imam Ali alayhi salam also, in one of his teachings and the advices to his sons, and on the other hand, in his will also, which he wrote for his two sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, he describes and he says, "Usikuma wa jami'a waladi wa ahli wa man balaghahu kitabi." I'm making a will and I'm advising both of you and all of my children and my family, وَمَنْ بَلَغَهُ كِتَابِي, and whoever, to whoever this writing reaches, I advise them, بِتَقْوَى اللَّهِ, to do not disobey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, وَنَذْمِ أَمْرِكُمْ, and have discipline in your life and have discipline in your works. Therefore, it is very important that the personality like Imam Ali alayhi salam is also advising us to have discipline in our routine life, in our daily life, in our work, in our matters that we have. We must have discipline, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same.
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the US certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civilli, Rome.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
And they think they can do the same thing here what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades, never had any issues with them whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along. And they've caused so much grief here. And the most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing to Press TV how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This homeland requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kenitra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria, but thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risk their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The 77th United Nations General Assembly has opened, with the UN Secretary General warning of a winter of discontent as many Western nations are economically reeling from the backfiring of their sanctions on Russia. Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi will give his first address to the UN on September 21st, with a focus on creating a more just world through economic multilateralism. Raisi met with French President Emmanuel Macron and top leaders of the European Union, but amid what Iranian delegates described as a very tense atmosphere. France and the other Western signatories have failed for years to adhere to the 2015 Landmark Agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Raisi told Macron that Europe needs to show that its foreign policies are guided by the sovereign interests of their citizens and actually separate from the demands of Washington. This week, Raisi will hold bilateral meetings with the heads of Iraq, Pakistan, Japan, and more than a half dozen other nations, as well as with representatives of a large Iranian-American community, a group estimated to be well over 2 million people. Raisi stressed that Iran is willing to reach a, quote, fair and stable agreement to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs to receive reassuring guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the accord, as it did in May 2018. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attaches from different embassies. To attend this ceremony, dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
Time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sides in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carver was behind the wheel of a car, hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organizers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian protesters took to the streets in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to condemn Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime, vowing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest comes following the desecration of the mosque by Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces. The mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. Hamas resistance movement has warned the Israeli regime against violating the sanctity of Al-Quds.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that mustn't be crossed. We hold the Zionist entity fully responsible for any attack in Al-Quds. The enemy will only open the gates of hell on itself. The continuation of attacks on the sanctity of Al-Quds will backfire on the Zionist entity and its settlers.
Israeli settlers regularly storm Al-Aqsa Mosque, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. The attacks and desecration of the mosque compound increased during Jewish holidays.
We salute our people in Al-Quds, and we say to them that Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza will not remain silent amid Israeli attacks on Al-Quds. We also call on all Palestinians and Muslims to mobilize to confront Israel's conspiracies against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have raised the alarm over Tel Aviv's plots to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque into Jewish and Muslim sections or sitting times for visits.
The Zionists have no right to be in Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's purely for Muslims since ancient times. They are trying to control Al-Aqsa Mosque, but all their attempts will be in vain.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. Observers say the world has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against the oppressed people of Palestine for decades.
Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In the limelight.
Government documents that President Donald J. Trump had accumulated were with him in roughly 24 boxes in the White House residence. They were to go to the National Archives, but at least some of the top secret and confidential documents ended up in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman, Katie Banner, and Glenn Thrush. The piece is titled, The Final Days of the Trump White House, Chaos and Scattered Papers. Four days before the end of the Trump presidency, a White House aide peered into the Oval Office and was startled, if not exactly surprised, to see all of the president's personal photos still arrayed behind the Resolute desk, as if nothing had changed, guaranteeing the final hours would be a frantic dash mirroring the prior 4 years. In the area known as the Outer Oval Office, boxes have been brought in to pack up desks used by President Donald J. Trump's assistant and personal aides. But documents were strewn about, and the boxes stood nearly empty. The table in Donald Trump's private dining room off the Oval Office was stacked high with papers until the end, as it had been for his entire term. Upstairs in the White House residence, there were, however, a few signs that Donald Trump had finally realized his time was up. Papers he had accumulated in his last several months in office had been dropped into boxes, roughly 24 of them, and not sent to the National Archives. Aides had even retrieved letters from Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, and given them to Donald Trump in the final weeks, according to notes described to the New York Times. Where all of that material ended up is not clear, but what is plain, though, is that Mr. Trump's haphazard handling of government documents, a chronic problem, contributed to the chaos he created after he refused to accept his loss in the November 2020 presidential election, unleashed a mob on Congress, and set the stage for his second impeachment. His unwillingness to let go of power, including refusing to return government documents collected while he was in office, has led to a potentially damaging and entirely avoidable legal battle that threatens to engulf the former president and some of his aides. Although the White House counsel's office had told Mark Meadows, Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, that the roughly 24 boxes worth of material in the residence needed to be turned over to the National Archives. At least some of those boxes, including those with the Kim letters and some documents marked highly classified, were shipped to Florida. There, they were stored at various points over the past 19 months in different locations inside Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's members-only club, home and office, according to several people briefed on the events. Those actions, along with Donald Trump's protracted refusal to return the documents in Florida to the National Archives, prompted the Justice Department to review the matter early this year. This month, prosecutors obtained a warrant to search Mar-a-Lago for remaining materials, including some related to sensitive national security matters. The investigation is active and expanding, according to recent court filings, as prosecutors look into potentially serious violations of the Espionage Act and obstruction of justice. Many questions about the mishandling of the documents led to Donald Trump, who often treated the presidency as a private business. But people in his orbit also highlight the role of Mark Meadows, who oversaw what there was of a presidential transition. Mark Meadows assured aides that the hurried packing up of the White House would follow requirements about the preservation of documents, and he said he would make efforts to ensure that the administration complied with the Presidential Records Act, according to people familiar with those conversations. But as the clock ticked down, Donald Trump focused on pushing through last-minute pardons and largely ignored the transition he had tried to forestall. A spokesman for Donald Trump did not respond to a request for comment. Mr. Trump himself has denounced the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago as a witch hunt. His office has said he had a standing order that materials removed from the Oval Office and taken to the White House residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them, although none of the three potential crimes cited in the FBI's search warrant depend on whether removed documents are classified. A lawyer for Mark Meadows has declined to comment. In his final speech as president, Donald Trump declared, "We were not a regular administration." His statement was indisputably accurate. From his first hours in office, Donald Trump had always taken a proprietary view of the presidency, describing government documents and other property, even his staff, as his own personal possessions. "They're mine," is how he often put it, according to former aides. But that was not the case. Under the Presidential Records Act, the law that strictly governs the handling of records generated in the Oval Office, every document belongs to taxpayers, whether the materials were national security briefings, reams of unclassified documents automatically uploaded to a secure server in Pennsylvania, or notes that Donald Trump routinely ripped up or flushed down the toilet. All were government property to be assessed and, in most cases, transferred as part of the nation's history to the National Archives. Donald Trump's lawyers and aides were well-versed in the Records Act, even if Donald Trump routinely flouted it. Donald F. McGahn, Mr. Trump's first White House counsel, instituted a protocol for the proper handling of materials and gave presentations under law to staff members, former officials, according to former officials. After the 2020 presidential election, White House officials held conversations about the fact that someone needed to retrieve documents that Mr. Trump had accumulated in the residence over many months, according to former officials. By the end of the Trump administration, the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his deputy, Patrick Philbin, were keenly aware that Mr. Trump's handling of documents was a potential problem, according to people in their orbit. But it is unclear how much bandwidth either man had to deal with the issue. Donald Trump was on contentious terms with Mr. Cipollone after the election and often berated the lawyer for objecting to his attempts to subvert Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory, according to former officials. Adding to the disarray was the absence of the White House Staff Secretary Derek Lyons, who managed paperwork inside the executive complex but had stepped down on 18th of December 2020. That left Mark Meadows, a former House member with no significant executive experience before joining Donald Trump's staff, responsible for overseeing a transition process the president wanted no part of. Mark Meadows' immediate